From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the program, we'll look at the issues facing national forests with the woman in charge of the eastern region, plus the philosophical and ethical dilemmas of the human genome. A historian is challenged to tell the story of the Civil War in 50 objects.
That was really tough. It was like Sophie's Choice times 10, picking the objects to represent the whole march from slavery to freedom.
And Milwaukee author Jenny Benjamin tries to capture the essence of an 18th century Italian peasant.
Anyone, I think, who writes, that's part of the process, is that you do whatever you can to really get in the shoes of someone that you're writing about. Whenever I did research or whenever I was imagining him in situations, I became him.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's great to have you with us on this Wednesday. Last week on the show, we spoke with the author of A History of America's Eastern Forests about the natural and man-made challenges that have shaped them over the centuries. The U.S. Forest Service manages tens of millions of acres of forest land across the country for the benefit of many stakeholders and for many purposes, commercial logging, recreation, and even wilderness preservation. The National Forest System is divided into nine regions. One of the most geographically diverse is Region 9, which runs from the Missouri River to the Atlantic Ocean. The region is headquartered here in Milwaukee and overseen by the regional forester, a position just filled by Kathleen Atkinson. She joins us in the studio to give us an on-the-ground sense of what the forests face today. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
I want to start with the impact of the sequester on national forests, and as simply as this question, how are national forests being affected by it?
Well, right now, we are in the process of getting our budget for this year, so we'll know better in the coming weeks. What we're doing to prepare ourselves, what we have been doing, is looking for cost efficiencies. Obviously, we're always trying to use the taxpayers' dollars wisely, but we've been looking for ways that we can streamline some costs and save money to hopefully reduce any impacts from the sequestration.
There were some much publicized impacts in the national park system. We've heard about parks with reduced operating hours or reduced amenities and such. That has not been the case yet at this point for the national forest system?
Not yet. We're, again, there may be some impacts with some reduced hours, but we're really looking to try to find some other ways to absorb those impacts.
Of course, one of the stakeholders involved in the national forests are timber companies and timber interests. Is the impact on the national forests of tight budget climates, is it going to put more pressure on the revenue generating side of the equation?
I don't think so. And I really am kind of also excited to see our shift in how we work with our wide range of publics. We're really, over the past couple years, have really been looking at a much more collaborative approach in working with the publics. And it's really exciting because that also kind of lends itself to developing more partnerships, which helps leverage our dollars also.
This is something that the Forest Service has been sensitive to in the past, is the criticism that it's managing the forests for the benefit of some stakeholders versus others.
Right. And again, I think by sort of approaching management on a more holistic basis, looking at a watershed versus just one resource area, it really allows us to draw in that wide range of public and get their thoughts and ideas on management.
We should point out that you are the regional forester. That means you are essentially overseeing Region 9 of the Forest Service, which is a pretty vast space. Describe what this region is and how – well, let's start there. I mean, Region 9 is based in Milwaukee. We do not have a national forest in Milwaukee, but where does it stretch?
It is a very large region. It goes from Minnesota to Maine to West Virginia to Missouri. Covers 20 states. That's 43% of the nation's population, 17 national forests, and one prairie.
So are there primary issues that face the region as a whole? I mean, are there commonalities within, you know, national forests in Missouri versus New Hampshire versus Minnesota?
I would say a couple ones spring to mind. One is forest health and keeping our forests healthy in the midst of a changing climate and preparing them for the future climate that might be slightly different than what we have right now. And also invasive species. We have a significant problem with invasive species, whether that's insects, plants, you know, mussels in the Great Lakes. It's a wide range.
Well, and in fact, let's stick with invasive species for a moment, because there is a lot of attention paid in this particular state to the emerald ash borer, and in places like Michigan as well. And I guess recently there was the news that the emerald ash borer has been found in even New Hampshire. This seems to be one of those issues that knows no borders. What is the Forest Service's role within the overall effort to either stem or control the spread of EAB?
One of the interesting things about forests in the eastern region is we do not have a solid ownership pattern, meaning within a proclaimed national forest boundary, it's not all federally owned land. Usually it's about half the land within the boundary is federally owned, and the other half is private. So we have to work closely with the private landholders, both to manage forests, to manage within the national forests, but also, like you say, it's really an all lands approach. So the Forest Service has several other branches, one which is state and private and one which is research, all of which have to work together to address issues such as these.
Are you feeling good about where that coordination is at this point? Obviously, the EAB has continued to spread at this stage.
Right. I feel good about how we're working with the private landowners and with the state forestry organizations. Issues like this are very difficult because they don't have a natural predator here. And so really we're in a mode of trying to contain.
There was the news out just recently that carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are at record high levels. You talked about the need to manage forests for future changes in climate. What does that mean? What is making a healthy forest today have to do with the climate that might exist 10 years from now?
Well, when you're talking about managing a forest, trees grow slowly, and it's a long-term investment. And so if you're thinking about maybe you're doing some reforestation in an area, you know, you need to be thinking about the next 80 years. Will the climate be the same? You know, are species going to move on the landscape? Are plants and animals going to move? And so we have to be thinking ahead and not just sort of replicating what was there at the current time.
I know one of the issues out west is when you get into forest health actually involves forest restoration, taking down trees to improve the health of the forest. Is that an issue in the eastern region? Are there forests that are unhealthy because they have been allowed to essentially grow unabated for so long?
I think one of the unique challenges in the east is because we acquired the lands because they were degraded. And so we set about doing restoration many, many years ago. But what that means in many cases is the trees are all roughly the same age. And so a healthy forest would involve a lot of different ages of trees. And so that's something that we're looking at and considering as we do management.
Your background seems perfect for this role. You've worked in recreation, in timber management, as a district ranger, as a silviculturalist. Is there one area in forest work that you feel like you connect with the best?
Well, that's an interesting question. I have worked in a lot of geographic areas and with a lot of resource areas. And to me, that's one of the fun things about working for the Forest Service is I've gotten to live all over, meet all kinds of people, and do vastly different jobs. And I've enjoyed that immensely.
I mean, I imagine no one necessarily goes into forestry because they especially enjoy working with budgets.
I'm
not saying you don't enjoy working with budgets, but I'm asking you to think back when you first entered the field. What was it about the field that connected with you in the first place?
So I grew up on a small farm in southwestern Michigan, and I used to love to go out with my father, and he would graft black walnut trees and make some very bad maple syrup. And so I really enjoyed just being outside, and that's what prompted me to go into forestry. So for me, it was a love of the resources.
Before you came out to Region 9, you went to work every day in Washington, D.C. Now your office is in downtown Milwaukee. Both cities have their fair amount of trees, but obviously neither is in the midst of a national forest. If you are someone who lives in urban America, how do you think our national forest system should touch your life?
That is a wonderful question. And so we have a program called Urban Connections, where we have individuals in some major cities, Detroit, Boston. And it's really important that we make a connection to urban youth and urban people in general to the land. And so that's a strong area of focus. And what we want to do is get people to really appreciate the national forests that they own and get to use.
So the idea is that connecting people to the land here makes them more interested, more invested in, more willing to go to the national forests beyond that?
We want to help people understand nature in general and the importance of the natural environment. And sure, we'd love to have them come out to the national forests. But if it also means that they become interested in small urban forests, that's wonderful too. We just want to connect people to nature.
We talked about how you originally got connected to nature. Even after all of these years doing it, what still gets you the most fired up about working in forestry?
When I get to go out to a natural environment, a national forest, and talk to people that are there and enjoying it, that just makes me feel so good. And it makes me feel very proud of what we're doing as the Forest Service.
Do you think there's an untold story about national forests that people don't appreciate?
I think so. Many people don't understand or know the difference between a national forest and a national park or a state forest. And I don't know that necessarily that distinction is important. Again, what is important is that they understand nature and that they appreciate it.
Not long ago, I chatted with the author of a book on the history of America's eastern forests. And one of the issues he was talking about that faces some, especially in the Northeast and in places like North Carolina, is rapid development in the areas surrounding national forests. Are those issues that the national forests themselves and the Forest Service can do something about, or is this another one of those cases where you really have to wait to see what happens outside and then deal with the after effects of, you know, a state's decision or a municipality's decision?
That's a difficult one, especially for the Eastern National Forest, because with our fragmented land ownership pattern, when people develop their private land, oftentimes that means they have a need for utilities that would cross national forest to get to their private land, driveways, roads. And all these things obviously have impacts on the environment. So it's really important for us to work with the local communities to try to minimize that. And, you know, because it's one thing if it's one house in the middle of surrounded by national forest. It's another thing if it's a highly developed subdivision.
Is there a single greatest challenge that you see as you look across the eastern region right now that the Forest Service has to deal with?
I think the greatest challenge I see is making that connection, again, with our population just increasingly urban, is making that connection and having people appreciate their national forest.
Well, I guess the other question I had for you is, you know, in years past, there has been this kind of push-pull between when it comes to wilderness management. I know in the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia, wilderness is a huge part of the equation, as it is in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area wilderness. Where is wilderness at this stage of the game? Are there other similar situations in national forests in the East where wilderness might play a larger role?
Well, you know, you recently had a guest on that talked about once you label an area, and you know, as wilderness, that it attracts a lot more attention. And that's something we've seen in the Forest Service too, because we have a lot of areas which are fairly remote, have a lot of the characteristics, but are not necessarily labeled as wilderness. But right now we have not seen a big push to do a lot of designation of additional areas.
Are there other aspects to what you do as the regional forester that you think people ought to know about?
Again, I would just kind of go back to making the connection of people to the landscape. And we do a lot of work with youth and going into schools and talking to folks. And I know it used to be more of a Smokey Bear message about fire. But I'm really excited to see us really working with schools and with nonprofit groups to really reach out to young people and bring them out to the forest and bring them out to other forested landscapes and have them just understand and appreciate the beauty of nature.
You wouldn't say that Smokey Bear is outdated, though.
Oh, of course not.
Smokey Bear perhaps ought to have a sidekick who can talk about the other recreational aspects of the forest.
Well, that's true, but Smokey still has an important message, and children love him too.
Kathleen Atkinson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kathleen Atkinson is the regional forester for Region 9, or the eastern region of the U.S. Forest Service, which includes Wisconsin. Its western border runs from Minnesota south to Missouri, and on the eastern side, it goes from Maine to Maryland. The news that a high genetic risk for breast cancer led Angelina Jolie to undergo a double mastectomy is shining a light on philosophical and ethical questions about genes. We'll dig in a little deeper when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Actress Angelina Jolie announced yesterday she's had a preventive double mastectomy after learning she carries a genetic mutation that puts her at high risk for developing breast cancer. That announcement has, for many, rekindled a dilemma about how much information we'd want to know about our genome and what to do with that information once it's in hand. It's a huge part of the field of bioethics these days, and so it makes sense to revisit an interview we did recently with Dr. Kimberly Strong, an assistant professor of bioethics at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Why is this point in time such an important one to be focusing on bioethics?
Well, I think my primary area is around genomics, so whole genome sequencing, whereby you're looking at the whole genetic complement of a person. And that technology has now come to a point where it's starting to be utilized both within the clinic. It's been utilized from a research perspective for a little while now, but now in the clinic that's starting to kind of eventuate. And so with the promise from the medical side of things come some bioethical questions, and those being really around privacy concerns, around ethical, legal, social issues are the areas that bioethics from the standpoint that I'm looking at.
Would you say, in a strange way, are these questions going at this stage from the theoretical to the real? I mean, it sounds like a strange way to put it, but, you know, 50 years ago, people would talk about the ethical considerations of cloning, but it was maybe an intellectual exercise as much as anything. Are there issues that are playing out today in which we've gone from theoretical to real tangible things at stake?
That's right. That's right. So we're now seeing some clinical outcomes where we look at genetics and we're looking at a whole genome and being able to realize whether or not we can provide diagnosis for some cases, undiagnosed conditions in the past. So that's where it's starting to eventuate as well, with some knowledge around pharmaceutical type drugs and the ways that someone's genetics might cause them to be more reactive or less reactive to those certain types of medication.
What is the level at which you think the most work needs to be done in terms of wrapping our heads around this stuff? Where do federal and state laws, for example, come into play?
Well, I think at the moment, people are starting to look at this. The federal government is putting out various calls for grant opportunities. So they're acknowledging the need for people to start doing some work around this area. And a lot of the calls have an LC component or an ethical, legal, social issues component. From that perspective, or from my own perspective, I think work needs to be done engaging with community we don't all have to be geneticists to be able to discuss this and think about it. And so I would say that from my perspective, that's a really strong focus of mine to make sure that I interact with various communities and really professionals as well as consumers.
How do you do that? What does that interaction look like? And what is the takeaway for the average person, if you will, who might not or might just now be starting to wrap their head around these ethical questions?
Yeah, well, some of the techniques would be to try and get groups together in focus groups or individual interviews in order to start assessing what people's hopes and fears are around these type of technologies. So with that in mind, I think the promise is something that gets into the media a lot. And at the same time, I think some of the far-reaching fears get into the media. But when it comes to really engaging with those and thinking about what values and such might be guiding someone's decision as to whether this is something they would want to pursue for themselves or a family member, that's the area of interest in particular for the program Genomics and Ethics.
I'm curious how much responsibility you think the scientists and researchers who are actually doing the work on this technology actually should bear in thinking the ethics through.
Well, I can say with the team that I'm working with at the Medical College of Wisconsin, they're thinking about these things. They're thinking about them both on a personal level as well as a professional level. I think it's one of the interesting things when it comes to genetics or any of this where it's a part of all of us. It's something for all of us to consider. So it isn't some sort of rare or unusual treatment or unusual test that lots of people might not have any interaction with at all. This is something that's personal for everyone. So I think that makes it in itself a really interesting thing to engage with.
Do you fear, are we behind the curve as it pertains to getting our heads around the ethics of genomic sequencing versus where the technology is? Or is that always the case as far as developments in medicine go?
Well, I would say that there's always a bit of a lag in this, but people have been thinking about these things. There are a lot of similar questions that are being posed that were posed back when we're doing genetic testing in general for single gene disorders. And again, I come back to it. In this case, it's the amount of information and the fact that we're looking at things and we may find things that we weren't expecting, because we can't possibly know all the sorts of things that we might find in someone's genome. We know that all of us carry various types of different gene changes that may or may not have kind of phenotype or physical manifestations at some point down the track.
Are there particular questions that you think people, just regular people, not necessarily scientists or bioethicists, should be asking themselves when they're reading about genome sequencing or when they're thinking about it down the road as something that may be relating to them?
Yeah, well, I would say that some of the things to think about from both perspectives. So you want to really assess what your hopes are. What do you hope to achieve by – what do you want to learn from this information? And then the things that might concern you could be around what things you wouldn't want to know and perhaps want to put some limits on the information that you're informed about. As well, who would you want to know the information once it's available? And what impact might this have on other family members? Again, that's another theme in genetics, that it isn't just about the individual, but it has potential implications for anyone who's genetically related to that person.
Well, Kimberly Strong, thanks so much for shedding some light on this for us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kimberly Strong is an assistant professor of bioethics at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Our interview with her first aired in January. The history of the Civil War told through 50 objects. We'll hear about some of them when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. The sesquicentennial of the Civil War continues this year. July will mark the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. Though the story of the Civil War is often told from the perspective of battles, regiments, victories, and losses, millions of artifacts bring the history of this crucial American moment alive today. One of the most expansive collections of such Civil War artifacts resides at the New York Historical Society, which recently challenged historian and author Harold Holzer to choose just a few dozen that would tell the story of the war between the states. The result is his new book, The Civil War in 50 Objects, and Holzer explains to Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce how he rose to the challenge.
Well, it wasn't easy, but the idea here is to tell a broad story through sometimes small, intimate, or grand pieces that people saved for posterity. The British Museum did this in the History of the World in 100 Objects, and so it's always a challenge. The Historical Society has 1 million objects, large and small, relating to the Civil War era. So they put out about 100 for me to choose from, and it was really tough. It was like Sophie's Choice times 10, picking the objects to represent the whole march from slavery to freedom, and trying to represent every kind of artistic and documentary medium that is represented in the collection.
Well, let's start with what you begin the book with, which is this artifact, these shackles that held a small child slave.
It's pretty brutal, and they're very small. They're pretty much life-size in this normal-sized volume. And it's probably maybe the most harrowing thing in the whole book. The idea that a tiny child would be kept at bay, and the reason, I think, that many of these, they were also called bilboes, the reason that children were shackled this way and then attached to other things is because on the journey to slavery from Africa, some mothers, desperate and fearful, would try in the middle of the night to throw their little ones overboard, really to sacrifice them so they wouldn't have to spend a life or the next generation spend their life in slavery. So it's so horrible, it's unspeakable, and these little shackles are the way that you can keep the mothers from sacrificing the children.
How did you balance bringing in aspects of slavery as the cause of the Civil War with some of the alternative explanations for the conflict that we hear tossed around a lot these days, states' rights and things like that?
Yeah. Well, I do have a bow to states' rights in that the mayor of New York was pretty much a secessionist himself. He wanted to maintain profitable trade with southern states. So he had the ultimate states' rights idea, which was to make a trade alliance with Louisiana, which was one of the first states to secede, and then to become an independent city-state. In other words, he wanted New York City to secede. Well, Abraham Lincoln made sure that didn't happen. So that's my one recognition that there were other factors at work, and some of them were commercial. But I'm of the view, and I think most historians are of the view, that there was only one cause of the Civil War. You can say secession caused the Civil War. The firing on Fort Sumter caused the Civil War, but nothing caused secession except slavery. And you can read that in all of the secession ordinances that were drafted by the states when they seceded and by the Confederate Constitution, which enshrined slavery as a virtue. I don't want to shrink from that as the cause of the war, and I don't think the book does.
Tell me about the challenge of trying to include objects that even in their own times had multiple interpretations and then bringing them up to date in terms of how we view them today. I'm thinking specifically of this painting of slave life in the South.
Oh, yes, the Eastman Johnson painting. And you're absolutely right. No one was ever sure what Eastman Johnson meant by this painting called Negro Life at the South. What is it supposed to show? It shows a rather contented group of people living in ramshackle circumstances and a mistress, a white mistress, emerging into the scene. The young black man plays a banjo. A couple is sort of spooning at the left of the scene, people looking out an upstairs window. I think it's supposed to show that life goes on for slaves. But Eastman Johnson so quickly became a sort of an abolitionist artist that I think you can easily interpret that he meant to say that the white woman at the right who is looking at this realizes she's looking at a vanishing world, a world that'll soon come collapsing down. But that's what makes art so interesting. You can read it so many different ways. The important thing is a really good painting also.
Indeed, you include several artistic representations. You include sculptures, political cartoons that were published, although you mentioned in certain cases they weren't published or distributed as widely during the war as they would perhaps after. Do we often give enough credit to the fact that there was an ongoing public dialogue that was being reflected in the arts at that time?
You know, that's a beautiful way of putting it. I've written about this for 40 years, and I will immediately steal your phrase and use it as my own. No, I'll give you credit. An ongoing public dialogue through art is absolutely true. It was not just editorials. It was not just the political. It was a battle of art. And the Confederates might have been equal players in that battle, but for the simple fact that they ran out of three things that were really important to wage that fight. One of them is artists, because there was universal conscription and only 80-year-old or 10-year-old artists would have been safe. The second is paper. They had huge paper shortages, so much so that, as this book shows, some newspapers had to be printed on wallpaper. And third, they ran out of ink. They just didn't have the supplies to compete. So the dialogue really narrowed down to that between Democrats and Republicans in the North, pro-Lincoln and anti-Lincoln forces in the Union states. But meanwhile, there was a generation of soldier artists and pictorial weekly artists who witnessed extraordinary things that tell huge stories in very small and intimate ways. And I think there's one example in the book. It's a Frank Leslie's artist sketching a group of African Americans wandering into a Union camp. You almost can't even tell what it is. It just looks like a group of silhouettes, some on horseback, some walking, with soldiers looking on, some not even looking on. Well, why is it important? Because it's an example of enslaved people abandoning their plantation because, A, they knew the Emancipation Proclamation legally set them free if they could get away from their white masters, and, B, they had heard that Ulysses S. Grant's army was within a few miles. Now was their chance. They took their life in their hands. They fled. They walked into Union lines where they were embraced and recognized as free, no doubt put to work, but better than being enslaved. But the biggest story of all is who these slaves were. They were owned by Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy. And if this artist had not been on the scene to witness this huge ultimate rebuke of slavery, an institution that Jefferson Davis thought was divinely ordained, then we never would have had this record. So it's a tiny, almost unrecognizable sketch that tells a huge story.
Some of these objects have been written about so many times, you know, the copies of the Emancipation Proclamation, yet you managed to bring in not only a backstory to some of these documents, but you also find these other objects that could so easily be overlooked.
I tried. I was mesmerized by this sort of unattractive series of postcards. I guess they're postcard size, almost like index cards that had a series of buttons, brass buttons on them. And what they represent are soldiers, souvenir hunters, / scavengers who plucked buttons from the corpses of dead soldiers, or worse, went to Confederate or Union prison camps and traded liquor or extra food or tobacco for buttons. And they wanted to collect buttons. They had some intrinsic metallic value. And they were also like, they were like scalps. They were like trophies of war. So those are tiny, intimate items that tell sort of a scary backstory of the war. And then there were some things that were completely unknown to me. I've been writing about Lincoln for 40 years, and I never knew that Abraham Lincoln had, I knew of one example, but I never knew that the Historical Society had an earlier example of Lincoln going up to the War Department, where he went almost every night to get war news because the White House didn't have a telegraph. And there, taking a piece of War Department letterhead and jotting down electoral votes that he thought would lean to him or lean to his opponent in the 1864 presidential race. He was so nervous about finding a path to victory in that hotly disputed campaign that he almost did what Tim Russert did in 2000, putting together those charts with different electoral vote paths to the electoral majority. So here he was waiting for news of life and death from the battlefield, but also calculating his political life or death in the White House.
Which ultimately would have had an impact on the soldiers on the field.
And on emancipation, on everything.
Tell me about some of the objects you put together that kind of told the story of the soldiers from both sides and what their experiences were. In some of these objects, you really see that, particularly the letters, you see that the soldiers themselves are trying to make sense of the experiences that they're having.
Yeah, and you see things that you didn't expect. You see in Union soldiers' diaries, you know, racism, how they refer to the people of color that they encounter along the way. You see a desperation to keep life sort of normal. So Confederate prisoners do drawings of things like lice infestation and the infirmary, or they create their own newspaper written meticulously in almost calligraphic penmanship so that they could have something to read to pass around. They couldn't print it, so they made one copy and passed it around. You see a drum that a drummer boy used in battle with two bullet holes in it. And you see a flamboyant Zouave uniform, baggy red trousers, a fez, epaulettes, which were worn once upon a time by soldiers who were considered the toughest men in the army, almost like special forces. But they dressed in such a flamboyant way that they were huge targets. So, you know, amazing things, and amazing for their state of preservation as well.
What was perhaps one of the more surprising items that you came across as you went through the New York Historical Society's collection to compile this book?
The most surprising to me, without a doubt, was a copy of the Terms of Surrender between Lee and Grant at Appomattox. Ulysses S. Grant, when he went to Washington to assume the command of all the Union armies, went to a stationery store and was sort of entranced by this early carbon paper kind of a thing, thin, filmy, waxy paper that you could use to make copies. And when he was ready to ask Colonel Eli Parker to write down the surrender terms as he dictated them, he had Parker use this carbon paper and make four or five simultaneous copies. Then when he was done, he gave one to Lee, one to himself, one to somebody else to read, make changes, and then they did the final. When it was all over, Grant gave one copy to Colonel Eli Parker. Colonel Eli Parker was a Seminole Indian, and he stood out in this sea of very white faces. And when General Lee left the surrender room, he shook hands with all of Lee's staff, and when he came to Parker, he stopped sort of short, looking into this dark-skinned face. And then I guess he realized he wasn't black, that would have been too much for him, that he was a Native American. And he looked at him and said, "Well, at least there's one real American in this room." And Eli Parker looked right back at General Lee and said, "General Lee, today we're all Americans." So here is a memento of the final moments of the Civil War and a final confrontation where an American Indian had to be the one to say that unity meant racial unity as well.
Why use objects to tell the story of the Civil War instead of just using any one of the stories you present in this book to illustrate what the Civil War was about?
You know, there are so many ways into the story. I think this combines a kind of darting in and out of different story approach. But it also is almost a tactile way of looking at the war. You can feel and touch objects. You can't really, but you can come so close with this wonderful color reproductions of these items that stand out so beautifully. And appreciate the artistic involvement, the preservation, the respect that people had over time, the commitment to keeping diaries, and the political determination to sign a 25-foot-long petition to end slavery in America, saving the flag that was waved from Broadway when the first New York regiments went off to war. There's a lot of emotion involved in objects, and I think the emotion comes through to the reader. It's not just about military strategy. It's not just about politics. It's about passion. And the passion is what I was hoping to recreate through this kind of visceral path to the history of the war.
Well, Harold Holzer, thank you so much for sharing the Civil War in 50 Objects with us.
Thank you for asking me.
Harold Holzer is the author of The Civil War in 50 Objects in partnership with the New York Historical Society. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Holzer has written and edited more than 40 books on Lincoln and the Civil War era and has won the National Humanities Medal. One last break, and then what's behind the parallel plot of Milwaukee writer Jenny Benjamin's new novel, This Most Amazing? This is Lake Effect. from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee writer Jenny Benjamin's new novel spans hundreds of years and thousands of miles. This Most Amazing is set in modern-day Milwaukee, but also in Italy just before the turn of the 19th century. The book weaves together the mysteriously linked lives of a poet named Dahlia and a peasant named Vincenzo. The novel is just out, and Jenny Benjamin will read from it on Friday at Boswell Book Company, but she joins us now in the studio to share the backstory. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
Where did this novel start for you? I mean, a significant part takes place in Milwaukee, which is understandable, but where did your interest in Italy come from?
Well, I'm half Italian, and my family actually comes from the village that is the main setting in the novel. It's a family story I heard a lot of times at family gatherings with on my dad's side. That's the Italian side. And the story would go that my great-great-grandfather was in the army when Napoleon was coming in with his Italian campaigns. And just he and a few others got tired of fighting, so they just walked home to Valle di Brea, and that's the village. And then he was in jail, supposedly, and he met his future wife at the village jail because she brought the food. And that was the story that mystified me for years.
The modern day part of the story does play out in part in Milwaukee. And your main character, modern day main character, is Dahlia. And she is a poet and a teacher as well. And I gather this is not too dissimilar from your own background.
Very similar, yes. Actually, all my writing – I've written fiction my whole life, but my first love with writing was poetry. And that's what I focused on when I got my master's and always thought, well, I will publish a poetry book. It never happened. You know, volumes unpublished in my drawers. But so, yes, and I'm also a teacher as well. I taught a high school for at-risk students for 11 years here in Milwaukee. And the character is very similar. I've already gotten a lot of questions that I'm Dahlia because it's then that section, that part of the novel is first person. So, but I'm just as much Vincenzo as Dahlia, you know.
Well, I was going to ask. So at what point did you marry these two ideas in your mind and decide that they were actually one story?
For years, I wrote poems about the story, the family story I told you about. And it would crop up in different narratives or different types of poems. It just all the time. I was fixated on it. And then it was after the birth of my third daughter, and I was knocking around the Vincenzo part. I couldn't get it to work, and I was thinking it has to have two different time periods. What's going to be this connection? And then after Allie, my third daughter, was born, I got this idea of linking the two somehow, and Dahlia cropped up, and that's where she was born.
I'm always curious to talk about the process when it comes to a book that has a parallel structure like this. I mean, it plays out in modern-day Milwaukee and then later modern-day Italy, and then also at the same time Italy during the Napoleonic Wars. Did your writing jump back and forth, or did you lay out each track individually and later weave them together?
That's a really good question. I wrote them simultaneously, and so when I outlined, I was very structured with this. Other things I'm not always, and to know where I was leading. And so what you see now is divided up quite differently, but I would do these big chunks of Vincenzo and then a big chunk of Dahlia. And then once I finished those chunks, I would go back. So they were written at the same time.
You write as Dahlia for half the book, and you write very knowingly as Vincenzo for mm-hmm. part of the book. Was it difficult for you to get into the mind of a male character?
That's a good question. It wasn't at all. He's so dear to me, and I don't know anyone I think who writes, that's part of the process, is that you do whatever you can to really get in the shoes of someone that you're writing about. And so whenever I did research or whenever I was imagining him in situations, I became him in a sense. Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Vincenzo. I mean, I think we have a thumbnail sketch of who Dahlia is at this point, but what makes Vincenzo tick?
Well, he's an artist too.
He grew up in as a shepherd as well. His family are they're shepherds in outside of Valeta Brea, and but he always drew, and his mother encouraged this. And then when he volunteers to go with the French to fight to and acting like his brothers are not there.
Right. He volunteers essentially to save the rest of his family from getting conscripted into the French army.
Exactly. So that sacrificial move is very much in part of his character. And but when it comes down to it, the actual, you know, fighting is difficult and it brings out a rage side, too, that he does have. He's has that as well. So he's a really complicated character and very interesting to think about and to cast, you know.
Well, and the theme that crops up in both your Vincenzo character and in Dahlia is this idea of the – I think it's the wounded place inside them.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think with Vincenzo, that wound – and I, this doesn't give anything away because it's very much at the beginning of the book. The catalyst for him leaving and deserting is he broke off in the battle at Rivoli and chased down an Austrian boy, you know, and kills him just in the back. And it's a brutal scene and it tears him apart. It's his wound, and the rest of his journey is dealing with that. Now, Dahlia, it's a good question.
It's a little. Know? It's definitely more subtle.
It is more subtle, and you know, she speculates and has her whole theory. She's an interesting character too, in the sense of makes up her own theories and philosophies and kind of scripted together ideology. And some of it is that. Sometimes these wounds, these deep wounds, stay with us through various lives.
And we don't want to give too much away, but very early on in the book, I think the opening scene in the book, we learn that Dahlia is somehow tapping into these experiences, yes, that Vincenzo had a couple centuries before.
Yes. And that is the opening scene that she basically, as the story goes on and meeting her love interest is Jonas, who is an artist, and those that experience and that relationship ignites these scenes. She begins when she sleeps. She realizes these are not just dreams. These are recurring scenes from the life of this very specific person.
And again, we don't want to go too far along in the story, but we should mention Vincenzo's love interest in this. This is Ottavia, and I don't know how much you want to say about her.
Ottavia is very much the story I had told you that was the catalyst of the story of my fictionalized version of the family,
sure,
story. She is the daughter of the village doctor, and she's the one bringing the food. Her cousin, Paolo, is the one keeping track of Vincenzo while he's in the cell. And, well, Vincenzo falls instantly in love when he sees her.
How long have these characters been a part of your life?
Well, Vincenzo, the stories for – I can't even remember when I first heard the family story. So, but really me trying to write about it in poems goes back probably 10, 15 years. And then – when I really got the idea to connect them, these two different timelines, that was since 2009 when I really started drafting it.
Given how long they have been with you, was it hard to end this book?
Yeah, I was happy to end it because you just get to where – you know, I always say this when I'm writing something. It took me – especially a poem. Oh, it took me 5 years and 5 minutes, and that kind of feeling of – you so much of it is just thinking and imagining and structuring over and over and over. So then when I actually got it, what I wanted to do and the story I wanted to tell, and I got it all mapped out, I was really happy to get that first draft done. And then, of course, there's the revision and stuff.
What was the hardest part of the process for you?
I think the hardest part was making sure that the two lines jived okay and to run some themes throughout that would be an underlayer that could connect them as well. And that went through drafts because, like I said, when I wrote these huge chunks, that wasn't there. And it took in the revision process to really bring that bottom layer out.
And as you say, Dahlia is not strictly speaking an autobiographical character, mm-hmm, but how different was Dahlia when you first conceived of the story and the Dahlia that actually shows up in the book today?
Well, I think in the very first version of her, she was a bit much, and I won't swear, but she, you know, she was kind of just too much, especially in with Jonas and with her love interest, that she came off too harsh, too biting.
She does have her own rage that that parallels in a strange way Vincenzo's, mm-hmm. although not a violent rage.
Exactly. And I was just thinking about that the other day when I was here. The characters are coming up in my head a lot more now as I'm talking about them. But they both do have world rage, which I think is very important in many ways for change, but also for them, you know, that connection to them. And it does. And it comes out, and she's not afraid to say it, and she's a really alive character.
Well, what is your thinking about the idea of channeling experiences that have happened centuries before?
Well, I think that I'm very similar to Dahlia in this idea of, you know, are we a universe that trades lives or trades souls or things like that? And again, it comes back to having children. And after I had children, and you have kids too, or when they come out, it's like, wow, this is an old soul. And especially with each girl, I have three of them that came out, they looked like older and older souls. And just this idea of are we connected? And our bodies, our DNA is connected very much to, you know, our ancestors too. So it really got me thinking and playing around with the characters and what happens in the story.
I'm curious, as I read the acknowledgments and everything around it, there must be a story to this. This book is published in Cyprus.
Yes, it is. There is a good story to this. You know, when you're submitting to – a lot of times you can go the agent route as a writer, or small presses. You don't necessarily need an agent because they're more open to unsolicited manuscripts. And when I first started, I was done, and I started pitching it to agents. I got a lot of responses that wanted to see it, but usually it came back with, you know, we don't know if we can sell this. And I really like this, but I don't like this. I can't take it on. And then I had a couple of close calls with smaller presses, and it just said to myself, maybe this is a small press book. So I really focused on smaller presses. And a friend of mine in my online writing group, Sandy Brawl, she on Twitter said, hey, Jenny, I saw that there's this press in the Mediterranean. Your book's set in the Mediterranean. You should send it to them. And that's how I found them. So, yeah, they're on Cyprus, and it's pretty neat.
Well, Jenny Benjamin, thanks so much, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Jenny Benjamin's new novel is called This Most Amazing, and it's published by Armida Books. Benjamin is a freelance writer, poet, and teacher who lives in Milwaukee. She'll read from the book and discuss it on Friday evening at Boswell Book Company. There is a link to more about her from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's all for the Wednesday edition of the show. We have an all-new website at WUWM. The redesigned site went live this week and has all the features of the old site, plus more content from NPR. Come on over, look under the hood, and kick the tires at WUWM.com. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.